Hello and welcome to Renovacation, the media and film education podcast with me, Richard Eno, aka Reno. It may be difficult for some of you to imagine just how homophobic our past was. In the 1980s, which really wasn't that long ago, the Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and her government introduced a new law called Section 28, which prohibited the promotion of homosexuality. This meant that schools could not do anything which could be considered a promotion of a gay lifestyle. Now, I was at a local school within the multi-academy trust my college is part of recently, and was amazed to see such a vibrant and positive display of LGBTQ plus pride displays. This kind of thing could never have happened when I was at school. I mean, unthinkable. But here we are in the 21st century, and whilst there are many things we are still working on, it's important to reflect on how far we have come. But how did we get here? I watched a documentary on Netflix recently called Hating Peter Tatchell and was reminded of the incredible work this human rights and gay activist has achieved over the last 50 odd years. The things he did and stood up for, it's mind-blowing. It's called Hating Peter Tatchell because he upset a lot of people. Basically, he made people think and look at things they would rather ignore, such as the rights of fellow human beings. I felt an overwhelming feeling of pride and thought I'd just have to reach out to him. So I did. Here's my interview with one of the bravest men in the universe, Peter Tatchell. We have gay marriage, equal age of consent, equality in law. Job done, right? Homophobia is behind us. Why should we continue to fight?
Well, of course, we have made extraordinary gains. It is important to remember that up until 1999, Britain had by volume the largest number of homophobic laws of any country in the world, some of them dating back centuries. Yet, just 14 years later, by 2013, with the legislation of same-sex marriage, we had some of the best laws. That has got to be one of the fastest, most successful law reform campaigns in British history. It's a phenomenal tribute to the tens of thousands of LGBT plus people and our straight friends and allies who campaigned to secure an end to discriminatory laws. But, you know, it ain't over yet. You know, we have some great equality laws, but written into them are limited qualified exemptions for religious organizations. So this includes not just places of worship like mosques, synagogues, and churches, but also faith-run schools, hospitals, nursing homes, and shelters for the homeless. In certain circumstances, they are still allowed in law to discriminate against LGBT plus people if they can demonstrate that it's necessary to maintain the ethos of their faith. On top of that, we still don't have a ban on LGBT plus conversion therapy. This is the therapies which seek to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity, even though the government promised to ban it over 3 years ago. We still don't have reform of the Gender Recognition Act, which in 2004 was a big advance, but now is rather behind the curve. It still takes trans people a whole load of hoops and hurdles to go through in order to get legal recognition in their affirmed gender. So, you know, the simple way forward, which other countries like Malta and Ireland have adopted, is for trans self-ID. The trans person can, by statutory declaration, which is a legal document, affirm then their gender identity and get a new birth certificate, a new passport, and so on. So those are a number of issues. Plus, if we want to look at schools, still today, nearly half of all young LGBT plus kids in schools say they're being bullied on account of their sexuality or gender identity. Nearly half. And on the street, more than a third of LGBT plus people have been victims of homophobic, biphobic, or transphobic hate crime in the last 5 years. So there still is work to be done.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So a student asked me, how do you become a professional activist? I mean, is the money good?
Well, I don't regard myself as a professional activist. You know, I began at the age of 15 at school, doing campaigning in my spare time, you know, after school hours on the weekend. Over a period of time, I got quite good at it. And that sort of made me really want to do more. You know, I saw that I helped contribute to successes. And then lots of people came to me and said, look, you know, you're very good at doing this. Will you help us with this campaign? And so it's just been like one thing after another for the last 54 years. For 45 of those years, I was unpaid. You know, I never received any payment. I had to, well, struggle to do bits of freelance research and journalism to keep my head above water. But I was living on, you know, £5,000 to £7,000 a year most years, which in London is very, very tough. But nevertheless, my passion drove me onwards. You know, I now am paid as director of the Peter Tatchell Foundation, which was set up by friends and supporters, not by me. They set it up because they wanted to ensure that I had an office, staff support, and funding to do the work. So, you know, it's only very recently that I've got any kind of income, and I'm working like still on average about 14 to 18 hours a day. It's a very onerous workload, but I love it. I love it. And particularly when I see successes, either helping individuals get an injustice put right or helping campaigns succeed, that's what drives me on.
So I watched the documentary on Netflix, Hating Peter Tatchell. Fantastic title, by the way. How did you feel about that title?
Well, it came about because back in 2015, the director, Christopher Amos, was very surprised there'd never been a documentary about my 5 decades of campaigning. So he wanted to do something. And then as he did his research, he was shocked and quite horrified to discover that there was so much hatred and vitriol against me, mostly from homophobes and far-right extremists. So that's how the title Hating Peter Tatchell came about. And I think in terms of something which reflects my life and what I've had to put up with, it's very true. And also it does grab people's attention.
Yeah. One of the things that I really enjoyed seeing, pleased to remember, was when you tried to citizen's arrest Robert Mugabe. Did you have a plan to think about what would happen if you actually did arrest him?
Well, that came about because human rights defenders in Zimbabwe contacted me and asked me to try and do something to highlight the Mugabe regime's human rights abuses. This was in the late 1990s. Back then, the abuses were not being reported much in the West at all. And there was no campaign really of solidarity. Mugabe regime was disappearing people, torturing them, detaining them without trial, even in some cases killing them simply because they were critics of his regime. So it was pretty horrific and pretty extreme. My response to that request was to organize a series of protests outside the Zimbabwe High Commission in London. And they sort of made a bit of an impact, but not much. So I thought, well, I've got to do something a bit more dramatic to try and get media attention in order to get the story told about what Mugabe was doing to his own people. So I came up with the idea of using the power of citizen's arrest. In British common law, any citizen, any person has the right to conduct a citizen's arrest if they have evidence that points to someone having committed a criminal offence. And I had the evidence that President Mugabe had authorized and acquiesced and indeed condoned the torture of two black journalists, Ray Choto and Mark Chavunduka, who worked for the Standard newspaper in Harare, Zimbabwe. So that was the legal basis of my attempted arrests. Now, of course, then came the big challenge, when and where and how. I was sitting on it for the idea for actually several months. Then late in October 1999, I received a phone call around midnight by a person with quite a thick African accent who said that I might be interested to know that President Mugabe had arrived in London on a private shopping trip. He was staying at St. James's Court Hotel near Victoria, and he was scheduled to fly back to Zimbabwe at 6 p.m. on the Saturday night. Before I could ask any questions, the caller hung up. So I thought to myself, is this genuine? Is it a wind-up? I wasn't too sure, but I thought, well, let's just give it a go. Let's assume this was a genuine tip-off. So the next morning, I phoned around lots of people asking them if they would come along and help me put Mugabe under arrest as he left his hotel in the morning, because presumably he was going out. At some point, he had to go out. I was shocked by how many sort of plausible excuses there were. So in desperation, I turned to the LGBT plus group Outrage, which I was involved in. You know, it had a long history of doing nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience. So I knew there'd be people there who were up for a go. And sure enough, three other volunteers came forward. So although we weren't arresting him because of his homophobia, and certainly Mugabe was very, very homophobic, we were arresting him on charges of torture. Nevertheless, these three other LGBT plus activists from Outrage wanted to do something to support the people in Zimbabwe. So we knew he was going to fly back, according to the informant, fly back to Zimbabwe at 6 p.m. on Saturday night. So at some point on the Saturday morning, he'd have to leave his hotel to go to the airport. So we lay in wait outside the St. James's Court Hotel, near Victoria. We got there at about 8:30 in the morning, in case he was a very early riser, and then sort of busied ourselves to sort of try and look inconspicuous. You know, one guy stood in a phone box pretending to make phone calls. Another stood at a bus stop reading a newspaper. I was looking in shop windows. But you know, after 2 hours, by about 10:30. It was very difficult to not look obvious, because that's a big posh hotel and there's a concierge, a guy in top hat and tails, who stands on the steps to greet new visitors, new hotel customers. And he must have noticed us. And I saw him very studiously looking at each of us and clocking us and then disappearing. And I thought, oh, if he thinks we're trouble or there's any danger here, he'll call the police and the whole plan will go up the Swanee. Sure enough, a little while later, out from the vehicle side entrance by the VIP apartments came five or six African-looking men who stood and started pointing directly at us. And I thought to myself, well, my heart sank initially. Goodness gracious, you know, they're onto us. Yeah, it's not going to work. They'll call the police. We'll all be bundled away. President Mugabe will go off and do his Christmas shopping. But then my heart rose, because I thought, well, if these are African guys and they looked African, then possibly they were President Mugabe's security detail. And they'd been tipped off by the concierge of the hotel to check out who we were. So I had a mixture of elation and panic. And in those circumstances, it's very difficult to think clearly because you're so nervous. I mean, you know, the nervous anxiety of hanging around for 2 hours or more outside the hotel. You know, I was, you know, it was a cold day. I'm a skinny guy. I got goosebumps. I was cold and shivering. I had a splitting headache from the nervous tension. My stomach was turning over. I felt like I was going to throw up. But somehow, magically, out of that moment, I had a brainwave and I strode across the road straight to where these African guys were standing, smiling and beaming and holding out my hand as if I was going to shake theirs. I said, "Hi, guys, I'm from the News of the World. We've got a story that Elton John is in the hotel with his new boyfriend. Can you please tell us what room he's in?" And they sort of looked in disbelief and shook their heads. I said, "Look, come on, this is a big, big story. We've got to get in tomorrow's newspaper. I'll give you £50 if you tell us which room he's in." Shook their heads. They shook their heads. No. £75. No response. £100. Their eyes sort of lit up then. In fact, I only had £10 in my pocket. I was bluffing. I said to them, "Look, you know, these are my News of the World guys here. I've got my colleagues here, that journalist over there, that cameraman, that photographer. They're all from the News of the World." Actually, they were mainstream newspaper and camera people and video people who were there to record whatever happened. Anyway, they still weren't buying it. So I turned to one and said, "You can't fool me. I know you're part of Elton John's security detail because you were at his Wembley concert 2 months ago. I saw you there. We did the report. You were one of the security guards. You can't fool me." Of course, there had been no Elton John concert 2 months previously, and that guy certainly hadn't been there. But I bluffed again, and they fell for it this time. They all burst out laughing and then walked away. And then about 10 minutes later, out came President Mugabe in his limousine. I scratched the top of my head to indicate it was him in the car. And my three colleagues ran in front of his speeding limousine, forcing it to halt about 6 inches from their legs. Then one guy ran behind the car, so it couldn't move forwards and it couldn't go backwards. I ran from the left-hand side and opened the rear left-hand door. Amazingly, it was unlocked. I leaned in. There was President Mugabe on the back seat in front of me. I gently took his arm with my right hand and then held out my left hand with an open palm to show that I didn't have a weapon. I then said, "President Mugabe, you're under arrest on charges of torture. I am now summoning the police." You should have seen the look on his face. Wow. He is very dark-skinned, but a visible ashen pallor came across his face. His eyes popped, his jaw dropped, he recoiled back into the seat, he held up his hands like a frightened 10-year-old kid. I thought to myself, he probably thinks he's going to be killed. And we aren't going to kill him. We're going to take him to a court of law and he'll have a chance to defend himself. But at least he will know what his victims feel like, you know, when his goons do kill them, the terror they fear. So we did summons the police. The police came. They were absolutely gobsmacked that it was the president of Zimbabwe in the car under our arrest. And then when we explained the legal basis and produced the documents to show that President Mugabe had authorized these two men's torture, instead of accepting it and even looking into it, the police knocked those documents out of our hands and then proceeded to arrest us. Now, there were only initially three officers. So it took, you know, two officers to lift one of us up and take and put us on the pavement. Then they went back to get the next person. And meanwhile, the person who'd been dumped on the pavement ran back in front of the car. At one point, one of our colleagues went right under the chassis and lay right under the vehicle. But in the end, reinforcements came and we were all arrested quite roughly and quite aggressively, I've got to say, given that we put up no resistance whatsoever, totally peaceful. Anyway, we were bundled off to Belgravia police station, where we spent the next nearly 7 hours in the cells. Meanwhile, President Mugabe was given a police escort to go Christmas shopping in Harrods. When it came to charges, we were initially bailed to go back to the police station, and then we faced a whole series of potential charges, obstructing the highway, criminal damage to President Mugabe's limousine, which was untrue. Riot and affray, which was also untrue, a very serious charge, which can get you jailed for several years. But then when it came to the actual trial, on the opening day of the trial, our defense lawyer made it clear that we were producing video evidence taken by the video cameraman with us on the day, which would show that up to 15 police officers were going to perjure themselves by making false allegations against us. So the court was adjourned briefly, and then soon afterwards we were told that all charges had been dropped. I guess also that probably the government didn't want a trial to go ahead because they feared that maybe a jury, if we went to a jury trial, a jury would rule in our favor, that we had acted lawfully to uphold the law against torture. And that would have set a precedent for the arrest of other heads of state engaged in criminal, tyrannical human rights abuses. The upshot was that, of course, we didn't succeed in arresting President Mugabe, but we did succeed in getting masses of global media coverage about not just what we did and why we did it, but the broader human rights abuses inside Zimbabwe. And in the weeks afterwards, I think I got probably about 5,000 messages, mostly email, from people inside Zimbabwe. And they all nearly all said the same thing. You know, we thought no one knew and no one cared. You've given us hope. You know, you've shown that tyrant is not unchallengeable, that he can be challenged, that he can be held to account, if not in law, then in the court of public opinion. So it was a great psychological and emotional boost for black and white Zimbabweans who felt neglected and ignored, who felt that the world didn't really care about what was happening in their country.
I mean, you could have made a documentary just about that one incident. I mean, it's amazing that you managed to get, your whole career into that documentary. So I really hope more people will watch that. So could you talk to me about the impact social media has had on human rights activism from your perspective?
Of course, social media has been a great boon in many respects. You know, by sending out emails, tweets, Facebook posts, you can alert thousands or tens of thousands, even millions of people about an issue or about a particular campaign. So my Peter Tatchell Foundation does use social media to publicize the things we do. So on the 24th of July, we had a Reclaim Pride march in London to reclaim pride from corporate and commercial dominance, to reassert the primary role of the LGBT plus community and our battle for LGBT plus rights. And we did that through email, through Twitter, through Instagram and Facebook. And within, just over 3 weeks, we managed to pull together thousands of people to come on that march. Now, if we'd had, the old fashioned way of leafing on street corners or phoning each individual person, that would have never worked. So it's made organizing protests and campaigns much easier. As I'm sure you all know, that many of the high profile campaigns online, which get hundreds of thousands or even millions of signatures, that's incredibly powerful. It really does alert people in power that there's a groundswell of opinion against what they're doing. So online petitions are also very good. And you may recall that some years ago, an online petition was launched to give the great mathematician and computer pioneer, Alan Turing, a royal pardon. And that was done through an online petition, which very quickly got over 50,000 signatures and put the government in a position where it felt obliged to act. And indeed, that royal pardon was granted. But having said that, also we know that social media can be incredibly toxic. Mm. And I'm really saddened by the way in which so many people abuse social media to attack other people in ways they would never dare do face to face. Make up fabricated stories, all kinds of slurs and smears about people, troll them, harass them, basically terrorize them psychologically and emotionally. That is the downside, and it's very, very, very damaging. And it's undermining what is or should be a great instrument or method for campaigning. Of course, online petitions are important and great, and I pay tribute to everybody who does them, but they're not sufficient. If you sign an online petition, it's essentially a private act that you do with your mobile phone or computer in your own house, or you do it yourself. The rest of the world doesn't know you've done it. Whereas if you go on a march, like the Reclaim March on the 24th of July, then the whole world sees you, or at least all the people on the streets around see you as you walk past. Social media sees you because images and stories are put out on social media, and the mainstream media, in many cases, will report that and alert through news reports possibly millions of people. If you get on BBC or ITV National News, you're reaching an audience of millions who become aware of the issue that concerns you. And that's, much more expansive and public than simply signing an online petition. The other thing I'd say is it's also great to have the solidarity and unity and of purpose that you feel on a protest march. With an online petition, you're just doing it all by yourself. But on a march, you're doing it with others, and you get a buzz, you get feedback, you get a sense of camaraderie and community when you're there with others.
I've got a controversial question. Why do you think trans identity and trans issues are so controversial, and sometimes even within gay groups?
Well, of course, trans rights are the frontline battle and the struggle for LGBT plus freedom. Trans people are on the receiving end of toxic, hateful campaigns, very similar to the ones against lesbian and gay people in the 1980s.
Yeah.
They're being denounced as perverted, sick, a threat to women, a whole range of different things, which are just simply not true. And I feel that it's really important that we stand in solidarity with trans people, particularly trans women, who get the biggest and most hateful and most toxic attacks, both in the mainstream media and also online on social media as well. Let's just remember that, like other women, trans women are victims of misogyny, prejudice and discrimination, hate crime, and sexual assault. They go through very similar things to other women. And that ought to give all women, including trans women, a common interest in working together. Dividing and separating is not going to help anyone. The idea that trans women are a threat to other women is nonsense. How could less than 0.5% of the population of this country be a threat to 52% of the country's population who are women? It just doesn't stack up. And of course, there have been a few incidents where some trans women have done bad things, but that's not representative. We don't demonize all Muslims as terrorists or a threat to society just because a handful, a tiny minority, commit terrorist acts. No one decent would do that. But some people seem to think it's okay to do that with trans people, to suggest that because of the bad deeds of a handful of trans women, that all trans women are therefore a threat to other women. In terms of trans rights and LGBT plus rights, there are differences. To be lesbian, gay, bisexual is different from being trans. That's true. But we share a common experience of being gender nonconformist. So lesbian, gay and bisexual people tend to, on the whole, not in every case, but we don't fit the traditional patterns of masculinity and femininity, male and female. We diverge. So without indulging in stereotypes, in general, gay and bisexual men tend to be more in touch with their feelings, less macho, more attuned to a different way of being a man.
Yeah.
Same with lesbian women and bisexual women. They don't fit in with neat, stereotypes about femininity. They're not bothered and not fussed about fitting a feminine ideal. Some do, of course, but a lot don't. And they've also played an extraordinarily prominent and influential role in breaking down barriers in traditionally male occupations where women were not seen or not supposed to go. So, for example, in the 1970s, the battle to secure women's right to take out apprenticeships in plumbing, carpentry, and bricklaying, that was fought primarily by lesbian and bisexual women. And of course, it's opened up those occupations now to all women, including those who are not LGBT. So I just think that, you know, don't focus on the differences. Stand together against trans people who are suffering a great deal of victimization.
Yeah. And like you said, a lot of those, a lot of that hate that they get online, you know, we had ourselves, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. So there's definitely some commonality there. Yeah. I have a question from a colleague of mine who runs our sort of safeguarding team. And she wanted to, she's interested in how do we safeguard young activists and how do we help them look after their mental health and well-being and avoid feeling guilty for not being perfect and not changing the world quick enough?
Well, of course, changing the world is a huge task. And sometimes you get quick wins, but often it's a long, hard slog. And you need to be in it for, you know, weeks, months, perhaps even years. And even if you don't succeed, you will have laid the foundations that others can build upon and succeed with. So I think probably the most important thing is to work through an organization. So, you know, if you're concerned about disability rights, the rights of women, Black and ethnic minority rights, and so on, join an appropriate organization, because there you will have the support of other people doing the same campaigning, and you can listen and learn from each other. You can give each other support when, you know, things get tough. So I think collaborative effort, cooperative effort, working together is key to maintaining mental health. And of course, if things get really toxic, just turn off. I've got to say, I do not look at my Twitter notifications a lot of the time. I would love to look to every and reply to every single one, but they are so toxic. You know, it would cause me, you know, a mental breakdown if I looked at them all the time. So I just switch off. And I think that's my advice to you. If people get toxic, just switch off, or, you know, block them and switch off. Stop looking at Twitter for a while. It'll pass.
Yeah, I think for some people, particularly young people, they get drawn into replying and then it fuels it even further. Yeah.
Don't feel under any obligation to reply, and don't be ashamed or embarrassed about blocking people. If people are treating you badly or others badly, block them. You know, it's simple as that. And, you know, it can be good sometimes to reply to people. You know, there's been plenty of occasions where homophobes or transphobes have attacked me and I've replied and put them right about factual inaccuracies. And in some cases, they have changed their mind. But that's not very often. So, you know, I think you need to assess the situation. If someone's an irredeemable bigot, the chances of you changing their mind is very small.
Yeah.
Don't feel obliged. Don't put yourself under the stress and pressure of replying. Just ignore or block them.
So I remember growing up and seeing artists like Boy George on Top of the Pops. And, you know, when I look back, I think they were only kind of hinting to their sexuality, even like people like Elton John. But then today we've got artists like Lil Nas X, Orville Peck and Ollie Alexander, who are so open and proud of their sexuality. And I just can't help but think how that's going to impact the future. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, of course, it is a complete game changer from the 70s, 80s, even 90s. It's amazing and wonderful that so many artists now feel able to be out and open, and that removes from the burden of leading a secret double life and fearing tabloid exposure. But it also is great for young LGBT plus people to see young pop stars their own age or a bit older who are out and proud. That's a great psychological boost, and it's a reassurance. It helps improve the mental health of young LGBT plus kids to see those role models. I think we often forget that back in the bad old days, one of the reasons why there was so much mental health among the LGBT plus community was because there were no role models, or very few. And when I came out at the age of 17 in 1969, there wasn't a single public figure who was openly LGBT plus. No pop stars, politicians, TV personalities, nothing. Nobody at all. And that made it very hard for people of my generation to feel good about themselves. Yeah. So this change of atmosphere and this new openness is absolutely fantastic.
So I'll wrap things up in a moment. But I just wanted to ask, you know, what's next for Peter Tatchell? You know, what's next for you?
Well, as I said, I've been going for 54 years already. I'm 69 now. Wow. I'm hopeful there's another 26 years of me. So maybe retirement about 95, but actually I doubt I'll ever fully retire. I'll probably still write letters to the press or things like that. And
yeah,
maybe in my old age, you know, still manage to go to LGBT plus pride parades. I hope. But for me right now, some of the issues I'm focusing on, I mentioned earlier, you know, to ban LGBT plus conversion therapy, secure reform of the Gender Recognition Act, end the detention in prison-like conditions and the deportation of LGBT plus refugees who are fleeing persecution in homophobic countries like Saudi Arabia, Russia, Uganda, and Iran. We really have to stop the way in which these people who have often suffered incredible abuse, violence, are stuck in asylum detention centers, which are prisons by another name. It's just so, so wrong that we compound their suffering. Also, of course, for me, a lot of the focus is on the global battle for LGBT plus rights, where there are still 70 countries or jurisdictions where male homosexuality is totally illegal. And in 44 countries, female homosexuality is still also illegal. So there's a battle there, and particularly in the 11 countries where same-sex relations carry the death penalty. These are Muslim-majority countries like Mauritania, Yemen, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. They have the death penalty for same-sex relations in the 21st century. It's unbelievable. And then there are 37 countries where trans people are either explicitly or by interpretation of law criminalized. So there are lots of global battles still to fight, and we cannot rest until every LGBT plus person on this planet is free and equal. It's a global struggle. It's not UK based. It's a global struggle beyond borders. And so solidarity with others in, you know, often tyrannical homophobic regimes, we have to stand with them.
You really are an inspiration, and I can't thank you enough for agreeing to talk with me. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and I hope that people viewing this video or podcast will be inspired to do their own bit. You know, I do my bit, and so do many others. We need more people taking up the cause to champion LGBT plus rights. Whether you yourself are LGBT plus or you're just an ally. Allies are really important as well. So collectively, we can change things. We have changed things, and we will continue to change things with your support. If you want to find out more information, please go to my foundation website, petertatchellfoundation.org. You'll see a resume of all the different campaigns and issues we're working on, both in Britain and around the world. And in the top right-hand corner, there's a little button which says join us. If you give us your email address, we will send you a weekly bulletin on LGBT plus and other human rights issues. Mostly very serious, but some funny and quirky ones as well. And it's totally free, there's no charge. So please sign up and become part of our little community for human rights. And finally, I'll just finish with my motto, which I hope will inspire you. Don't accept the world as it is. Dream of what the world could be, and then help make it happen. Thank you.
So thrilled that Peter agreed to this interview. The man is still outrageously busy, and doesn't appear to be slowing down. So the next time you see two gay people holding hands in the street or out and proud characters in TV, film and music, or you hear of a trans person coming out, spare a thought for Peter Tatchell, who helped make this all happen and is still fighting the good fight. You can find out more at petertatchellfoundation.org. Speaking out for human rights.